Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, August 17, 2023. Signatories of South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement are back to blame games.
This is another way of obstructing the implementation of the agreement. We are being charged of dragging our feet because we don't want the agreement to be implemented and because we don't want to go for election.
And a retired senior United Nations official says South Sudan's proposed 2024 elections is a recipe for another crisis in the country.
You can do elections without a center. That has been done several times. You can do elections partially, but it isn't the best. It is just to get rid of a transitional government.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan Focus. South Sudan's information minister has accused the country's main peace partner, the SPLM-IO, of blocking the road to peace. Michael Makuei-Luat says the SPLM-IO is yet to present their security officers to President Salva Kiir for commissioning in the command structure of the unified forces. For VOA News, Wake, Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Makuei says the recent moves by the SPLM-IO, including a walkout protest last Friday during budget discussions in the national parliament, could impact the implementation of the country's roadmap.
This is another way of obstructing the implementation of the agreement. We are being charged of dragging our feet because we don't want the agreement to be implemented and because we don't want to go for elections. This is another way of obstructing the way forward, and this is another way of obstructing movement towards election.
Oyen Nathaniel, the SPLM-IO deputy chairman, who also doubles as the first deputy speaker of the National Transitional Parliament, says SPLM-IO is working to finalize the completion of the command structure of the unified forces.
SPLM-IO, who have been dragging their feet during the transitional period and also during the transitional period which ended, including orchestrating a number of violations of the provision of the agreement. And up to now, we still witness delays in the implementation of security arrangement and other critical provision of the revitalized peace agreement.
Lawmakers from the SPLM-IO walked out during the parliamentary session last Friday, protesting some provisions in the South Sudan's 2023-2024 budget. Some South Sudanese say the decision by the parliament to approve a budget with 400% increase of civil servants' salaries was unfair. Christine Kide, a resident of Juba, says the 400% salary increment is not enough for civil servants who are struggling to put food on the table for their families.
The SPLM members of parliament were not looking at the suffering of the civil servants, because there is no way you will say you will increase 400% with the current rate. And we know very well that every day our central bank rate for dollar is shooting high. So what is the logic? All I am saying is that this particular group of people are intentional to keep the majority of the South Sudanese suffering.
David Ayuel Machar agrees with Kide's assessment. He says a 600% increase of the salaries of the civil servants could help families afford one meal per day.
The most biggest problem that we face in this country that encourages violence is when somebody is unable to bring food to the table for their children or their families. What will they do? They will resort to using powers that they have in their hands. For example, soldiers, they can use the guns to feed their families. So the only way we can do that is increase their salaries.
President Kiir signed the 2023-2024 budget on Monday amid a growing rift between the signatories to the 2018 peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu reporting from Juba.
Still on matters to do with South Sudan's peace deal, President Salva Kiir has continued to assure South Sudanese that the long-delayed elections will take place in 2024. But some South Sudanese living in the diaspora, including a retired UN senior political officer who served in four peacekeeping missions in Africa, says South Sudan's road to democracy is rough. For VOA News, Lucy Pony reports from Nairobi.
Some South Sudanese living in Juba and the diaspora are expressing worries about the credibility of the scheduled 2024 elections. Professor Peter Tingwa, a retired senior UN official who served in four UN missions in Africa, says given the enormous challenges in South Sudan, the country's leaders should work towards creating a suitable environment for a democratic transition.
Depending on the powers that be, you can hold elections at any time. It suits you. Even you can hold elections with the guns blazing. But if you care for credible elections, quality elections, democratic elections, and elections that will be accepted by the people and by the international community, then you don't do that. You can do elections without a census. That has been done several times. You can do elections partially, but it isn't the best. It is just to get rid of a transitional government in order to bring something that at least people have expressed opinion on.
Tingwa says credible elections can only be held if the government of South Sudan creates a civic space ahead of the elections, provide security for voters, enact election laws, and seek both technical and financial assistance for conducting the elections.
If the political parties will not be free to go and pick in Raja, in rank, in something, then that completely rules what is supposed to be election. Because you will not be determining the wish of the people. It will be a single party that is a dictatorship. So to me, I think what needs to be done immediately in order to give freedom for everyone to go everywhere and speak, restrain the security from arbitrary arrest of politicians.
Amer Manyok Deng is the chairperson of the South Sudan Women's Bloc and a signatory to the 2018 peace deal. She says the partners in the transitional government of national unity should implement the security arrangements, conduct comprehensive disarmament, and demonstrate a political will for allowing a democratic transition in 2024.
We don't know whether it will be credible because there are some few challenges that we see if they are handled with the care by the assistance and support from the IGAD and from the African Union and from the international community, maybe we can be able to achieve the fair and credible election in South Sudan.
Former Finance Minister Kosti Manibe, who is also a member of a group known as the Former Detainees, or FDs, argues that the signatories to the 2018 peace deal have done very little to complete the pending tasks in the peace agreement. He says holding credible elections in 2024 is a tall order for South Sudanese leaders who are struggling to implement the peace deal.
Many of the things require time. That is why in the agreement there is sequencing of events and certain timelines be met if you are going to have reasonably credible elections at the end of that period. Once you miss on those timelines in a very significant manner, then it's not possible for you to just hurry and do it, reduce the time substantially and still get credible results. That cannot be possible.
The UN mission in South Sudan says the signatories to the 2018 peace deal should complete work on the National Constitutional Review Commission, the National Elections Commission, and the Political Parties Council to enable the conduct of successful, credible elections in South Sudan. Jock Madut Jock, a professor of anthropology at Syracuse University in New York and the co-founder of the Juba-based Sud Institute, says holding elections in a hostile environment is a recipe for disaster. But he added that despite questions of the election's credibility, South Sudanese should be given an opportunity to choose their leaders.
We should call the bluff of our president, who says the elections must be held. Let us put them to test, him and his ruling party, the SPLM. Let us put them to test to see whether they will insist on getting power, even if getting that power risks the future of the country. Which is important for them? Is it the country or political power they have? Let us put that to test through the ballot box. It will also be a good step in planting the seeds of a democratic society.
South Sudan's government spokesperson and the Minister of Information, Michael Makuei-Lueth, has said on several occasions that President Salva Kiir is ready to take the country for elections in 2024. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Kampala, where Ugandan legislators have asked the army to beef up security at the border with South Sudan amid reports of repeated cattle raids by suspected South Sudanese rustlers. The raids are reportedly creating hostility between refugees and their host, as there are suspicions that the cattle thieves are colluding with the refugees. Ugandan security say they are in talks with their South Sudan counterparts over the issue. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The residents of Ugandan border districts live in fear following an increasing number of raids on their cattle by suspected South Sudan rustlers. The residents accuse South Sudanese refugees of collaborating with the rustlers. Officials in the area fear it could escalate into conflicts between refugees and their hosts. Oswin Sebastian Oguti is the Deputy Resident District Commissioner of Uganda's Lamor District.
The community are terrified. They are not happy. They suspect the spies that are always sending information to their counterpart in Southern Sudan living in Palabekam settlement. Because you cannot expect a foreigner to come from another country direct to where the heart are.
Nancy Achora, a legislator from Lamor District, says she is dismayed that diplomatic meetings with South Sudan officials about the issue have not yielded any action.
The people are very furious because we are hosting refugee who has come from South Sudan. And there are about 95,000 South Sudanese who are settled peacefully in our district. We feel so burdened, and we've had several interfaces with the ambassador of South Sudan, with the commissioners, and nothing has been done.
John Amos Okot is a legislator from Uganda's Agago district, which also has experienced raids. He blames the problem on lax Ugandan security at the border.
And the moment they do those atrocities, they enter in South Sudan's area. And people who are supposed to do business, they have the fear even to their life alone.
General David Muhoozi is Uganda's Minister of State for Internal Affairs. He says there have been collaborators facilitating the cattle raids, but notes that the two countries are tackling the matter together.
And these were tracked by security, and many have been arrested. Civil joint security meetings have also been held to discuss the problem of cattle raids from Sudan. And during these meetings, identification and arrest of collaborators and beefing up security along the borderline have helped to reduce these incidents.
Reports from border districts indicate that since 2018, at least 600 cattle have been stolen by suspected South Sudanese thieves, and only a small fraction were recovered. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Saturday is International Humanitarian Day. Find out what that day means to South Sudanese. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The United Nations says 62 humanitarian aid workers were killed around the world this year. Saturday, August 19, is World Humanitarian Day, a day set aside to remember aid workers who died in an attack on a UN headquarters by suicide bombers in Baghdad 20 years ago. Farhan Haq, deputy spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that South Sudan and Sudan remain the world's dangerous places for aid workers.
It's been very clear that Sudan, as well as South Sudan, are dangerous areas for humanitarian workers. The recent conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces in Sudan has put obviously a number of civilians in harm's way, but humanitarian workers have also been caught in the crossfire. And we are asking all of those sides in that conflict to abide by international humanitarian law.
But is anybody heeding that call? I mean, this call has been out there for over 3 months and they seem to be ignoring it.
Oh, it's true. We've had, as it is, nearly 4 months of conflict there, and there's been a huge number of violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. It has to end, and we are working with our allies, including the countries in the region, and with the African Union and other regional bodies to try to get the parties to halt all this. But it's been very, very difficult.
And what about South Sudan, Sudan's neighbor? They actually had more deaths than Sudan, where this conflict broke out between the two military factions. And Sudan is supposed to be relatively peaceful these days, but it clearly isn't.
Again, this is a problem, a case where the different parties on the ground, the forces loyal on the one hand to Salva Kiir and to Riek Machar, have again had different clashes with each other. We've been trying to resolve that and have had at least some measure of success, but it still is difficult. And one of the things that has been difficult, unfortunately, has been the provision of humanitarian aid. And again, this is one of the cases where we're trying to push and make sure that everyone understands that humanitarian workers, aid deliveries, hospitals should be kept out of harm's way. This has been a real problem. The targeting of hospitals and medical workers is a huge issue in those countries and in several others.
And what about some of the other hotspots in Africa? Some other countries were noted in the latest report about humanitarian violence.
Well, we want to make sure that things work out well for people, not just in Africa, but in other places. Obviously, we want to make sure that Mali is good, and there have been problems that we've had in Mali with the violence there. Outside of the region, we lost a worker, a staff member of the World Food Program in Yemen just recently. So there are many places where we want to make sure that that humanitarian law is followed, and it's not happening. You've seen also, again, in Ukraine, the large number of attacks on ambulances and on hospitals, and that has to stop.
What is the UN asking governments to do in these places where the violence continues? And what can they do when there are, you know, conflicts in the country, within the country, and they don't really have control over all parts of the country? But what can the government do that they're not doing right now?
Well, ultimately, they need to make sure that there are understandings on the ground so that no one fires upon aid deliveries, no one fires upon people who are providing medical assistance to the conflicting parties. There are many conflicts where different parties see those sorts of humanitarian forces and ambulance services as not being impartial, so they fire upon them, and that has to end.
This day, World Humanitarian Day, when was it commemorated and why?
World Humanitarian Day came about in honor of people we lost. We lost 23 people on the 19th of August, 2003, so 20 years ago. And so this is the 20th anniversary of what's known as the Canal Hotel bombing, when our main UN compound in Iraq was destroyed. One of the people who died there was the head of the UN mission in Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was also at the time working as the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So it's a day where we pay tribute to him and to all of the colleagues whom we lost in that terrible bombing.
That's Farhan Haq, Deputy Spokesperson for the UN Secretary General. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Damme from New York. A Sudanese political analyst is expressing doubts on the recent announcement made by the deputy chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council about a roadmap to end the country's four-month-long conflict. Abdullahi Ali Ibrahim says the international community should call on Sudan's rival military leaders to end the conflict in the country. Nabil Biagio has details from Washington.
Malik Agar, the deputy chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council, unveiled a government roadmap this week aimed at resolving Sudan's ongoing conflict, now in its fifth month. During a televised speech Tuesday, Agar outlined a process that commences with the ceasefire between Sudan's conflicting factions, followed by the separation of forces and the relocation of paramilitary units away from civilian areas. The plan includes the delivery of humanitarian aid and the introduction of a political process to restore constitutional order and guide the nation towards elections. Agar stressed that talks between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces could result into a permanent ceasefire. He says this war will end at the negotiation table, and it's a war that has political reasons related to the legacy of corruption and mismanagement of Sudan's diversity, which the country inherited from successive governments in Khartoum, particularly the ousted regime of former President Omar al-Bashir. He indicated that after a stable ceasefire is achieved, a political process, including a national conference, will be launched to find an inclusive solution to Sudan's frequent conflicts. He says building and establishing a post-war Sudan in a way that addresses the issue of reoccurring conflict in the country can only be achieved by the urgent implementation of the roadmap. This roadmap, he says, aims for, among other things, having one national and professional army and abolishing the existence of any military or paramilitary entities outside the command of the Sudan Armed Forces. RSF's advisor Yusuf Izzet told the Saudi-based Al Hadath TV that his group rejects the army's roadmap for ending the crisis in Sudan, adding that RSF leadership does not recognize Agar. Agar assumed the position of deputy chairman of Sudan's Sovereign Council after Sudan's military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan fired General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo following Dagalo's dispute with the Sovereign Council chairman. Political analyst Abdullahi Ali Ibrahim says Agar's outlined roadmap mirrors the army's previous stance presented during negotiations with the paramilitary in the Saudi town of Jeddah.
It's a rehash of what the government or the military in Sudan has been advancing at Jeddah. Basically, it is about, you know, the most important aspect of it, or part of it is convincing or persuading the rapid support force to evacuate citizens' residents. This is the most important thing. And this specific condition has been refused repeatedly by the rapid support force. So where is that going to take us?
Ibrahim argues that the presence of RSF forces within residential areas in cities across Sudan has inflicted significant suffering on Sudanese civilians and contributed to human rights violations. He says the international community should find ways of removing fighters from residential areas in Khartoum and other cities across Sudan.
The international community is not pressurizing the rapid support force enough for them to pick up this statement coming from Mr. Agar. Is it a statement to keep on pressuring the rapid support force to come to the realization that they need to leave the residences to go to any of their camps? And that was also very controversial because they say that we are in Khartoum. We are not camp people. We are just, you know, we have a right to be in Khartoum. So I'm kind of, you know, not really enthused by it as a way out of this. It is just the government is rephrased.
Sudan's four-month-long conflict has displaced millions of people and claimed thousands of lives. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio reporting from Washington.
From Washington, we move to Chad, where the start of the rainy season in Sudan and neighboring Chad is making it difficult to deliver aid to refugees from Sudan's conflict. In this report from the Chadian town of Androa, reporter Henry Wilkins looks at some of the logistical challenges faced by those trying to deliver aid and talks to experts about how Sudan's failed planting season means a desperate food emergency could likely get even worse.
Mohamed Kames fled western Darfur, where rights groups say atrocities against civilians are taking place, around 2 months ago. He arrived in Adamor, Chad, close to the Sudan border, where he thought he would be safe. He says upon his arrival, there was a sense of security and safety, but after the floods brought by the rainy season, homes were inundated, and there's a severe scarcity of food. Sudan and Chad's rainy season peaks in August and September. It's making access to Adamor very difficult for aid groups. VOA was only able to reach the refugee site in these amphibious all-terrain vehicles operated by the UN. Conventional vehicles like this truck carrying food aid to Adamor become stuck in thick mud. Attempts to rescue them unsuccessful. Ibrahim Mohammed Abdallah, a refugee who arrived 2 weeks ago, says the isolation in Adamor makes him frightened.
We have no security there. You know, we have no remain there alone. And even we are friends totally. That's why we also came to the border of Chad. I need help. I don't want to stay there because here is also, you know, it's very dangerous, my children.
Lack of access is not the only problem the rainy season brings. Humanitarians say its arrival also marks a grim milestone for Sudan. David Del Conte is a humanitarian and policy consultant who works with aid group Refugees International.
For much of Sudan, the planting season is over. All along the River Nile would be the planting season for much of the country's staples. So the situation in Sudan is such that we have a problem today that will be much bigger tomorrow.
Khartoum and its surrounding area, which sits at the confluence of the Blue and White Nile rivers, has been rocked by fighting between the Sudanese military and the paramilitary rapid support forces, making it almost impossible for farmers to plant. To add to his woes, members of Mohamed Karmis's family are still unaccounted for. He does not know if they were able to escape Sudan, if they are alive or dead.
Specifically my aunts and brothers, we have been unable to locate them.
For the refugees of Adamor, the unfolding tragedy, at least for the moment, has no end in sight. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adamor, Chad.
And that's all we prepared for you this Thursday, August 17, 2023. We now leave you with Khalid Didi and the song Aisha. Listening to Khalid Didi and the song Aisha. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Killer Williams, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.